Okay, so if you've got Bibles in front of you, the reading we're going to do is from the book of Jonah. In these Bibles, it's on page 653, and it's chapter 1, verse 1, down to the first part of verse 17. So Jonah, chapter 1, verse 1, through to the first part of 17. And that's page 653. The word of the Lord came to Jonah, son of Amittai. Go to the great city of Nineveh and preach against it, because its wickedness has come up before me. But Jonah ran away from the Lord and headed for Tarshish. He went down to Joppa, where he found a ship bound for that port. After paying the fare, he went aboard and sailed for Tarshish to flee from the Lord. Then the Lord sent a great wind on the sea, and such a violent storm arose that the ship threatened to break up. All the sailors were afraid, and each cried out to his own God, and they threw the cargo into the sea to lighten the ship. But Jonah had gone below deck, where he lay down and fell into a deep sleep. The captain went to him and said, "How can you sleep? Get up and call on your God. Maybe he will take notice of us, and we will not perish." Then the sailors said to each other, "Come, let us cast lots to find out who is responsible for this calamity." They cast lots, and the lot fell on Jonah. So they asked him, "Tell us, who's responsible for making all this trouble for us? What do you do? Where do you come from? What is your country? From what people are you?" He answered, "I'm a Hebrew, and I worship the Lord, the God of heaven, who made the sea and the land." This terrified them, and they asked, "What have you done?" They knew he was running away from the Lord, because he had already told them so. The sea was getting rougher and rougher, so they asked him, "What should we do to make the sea calm down for us?" "Pick me up and throw me into the sea," he replied, "and it will become calm. I know that it is my fault that this great storm has come upon you." Instead, the men did their best to row back to land, but they could not, for the sea grew even wilder than before. Then they cried to the Lord, "O Lord, please do not let us die for taking this man's life. Do not hold us accountable for killing an innocent man, for you, O Lord, have done as you pleased." Then they took Jonah and threw him overboard, and the raging sea grew calm. At this, the men greatly feared the Lord, and they offered a sacrifice to the Lord and made vows to him. But the Lord provided a great fish to swallow Jonah.
Thanks very much, Ed. If I'm not a familiar face to you, my name's Ian Taylor. I'm one of the members of staff here at Emmanuel. It's really nice to see you. You're very, very welcome. And today is the start of a little series we're going to be doing in the book of Jonah throughout January. And the book of Jonah starts like this. We just heard it read in chapter 1, verse 1. The word of the Lord came to Jonah, son of Amittai. Go to the great city of Nineveh and preach against it, because its wickedness has come up before me. Which begs the question, what right does the God of the Bible have to order one of his followers to leave home, go to a foreign city, and tell the people there that they are living in a way that displeases God? What right does he have? What right do we have here at Emmanuel to go to different parts of the city and start churches where the message that will be preached is there is only one way to be made right with God? What right do we have? What right do you have to say to your neighbor or colleague, you need Jesus more than you need anything else in your life? And the answer to those questions is down there in verse 9 of chapter 1. It's because the God of the Bible is the one who made the sea and the dry land. He's the one who claims to have created the whole world. And because he created it, he's also in control of it. He has total authority over everywhere and everything and everyone. It's what the Bible calls his sovereignty. We're on his turf and we're in his hands. Now, if you hear that message and it makes you grind your teeth in rage, then Jonah 1 is for you. But if you hear that message and it just flows off your back and you're not bothered by it, then you need Jonah 1. Because there are three things we're going to see about God's sovereignty in this, okay? We're going to get a perspective of his sovereignty. We're going to get the right response to his sovereignty. And we're going to see the goodness of his sovereignty. So let's have a look there. The perspective of God's sovereignty. Now, maybe you're thinking, hang on, you're telling me that this book and this chapter show us that God's in control. But really, as it was being read, it didn't seem that way, did it? Surely it seemed the opposite. God says, verse 2, he says to Jonah, his prophet, he says, go to Nineveh. And what does Jonah do, verse 3? Jonah ran away from the Lord, headed for Tarshish. He went down to Joppa, where he found a ship bound for that port. And after paying the fare, he went aboard and sailed to Tarshish to flee the Lord. God had said to Jonah, you need to go to Nineveh, modern day Iraq. You need to head east. And Jonah had got on a ship and he'd gone west. Okay? He's on the run. He is on the run. And as the ship pulls out of the port, we should all be thinking, who's in control here? Who is in control? Well, it's not long before we get an answer. Have a look at verse 4. The Lord sent a great wind on the sea, and such a violent storm arose that the ship threatened to break up. And all the sailors were afraid, and each started to cry out to his own God. And they threw the cargo into the sea to lighten the ship. See, Jonah's on the run, but the Lord will not let him get away. And the author of the book, he's really kind of intentional in the language he uses here. Because down there in verse 4, God is described as literally hurling a wind onto the sea. Okay, so he's hurling a wind onto the ship. The sailors, when they're throwing the cargo, they are literally hurling the cargo into the sea. Do you see? It's pitched as a battle of control. Who's in control here? God or man? And as we go along, we'll see how this pans out. But for now, here's the point. That the God of Genesis 1, who created the world, is the same God of Jonah 1, who controls the world. Every wave and wind and storm and swell obey him. Now, you can hear me say that, and it doesn't really register. You think, okay, yeah, wind and the waves obey him. But that's because we're indoors. Now, Christianity, I heard once described as a barefoot religion. Okay? In other words, there are some truths about the God of the Bible that you will not get unless you step outside your front door, out into the elements, and understand just what it means for God to be in control. Listen to this description of life on the Southern Ocean by the British yachtsman Robin Knox Johnson. He says, the wind had been building for a while, but was showing signs of easing. So I went on deck to see whether it was safe to put up some more sail. The swell was huge, 40 to 50 foot, but on its own, that is not a problem. However, as I looked astern, I could see a monster wave coming towards me, a combination of swell and sea at least 80 feet high, breaking at the top and stretching from horizon to horizon. It surged towards us, and I knew I had no time to get below, but I couldn't stay on deck or I'd be washed away. So I climbed the rigging and hung tight as the wave arrived and completely covered the boat in the middle of the Southern Ocean. Immense power from an immense God. No wave rises or falls in any ocean unless he lets it. That is his kind of authority we're dealing with here. It's huge authority. But it's not just huge authority. It's authority that goes right down to the smallest details, even the throw of the dice. So have a look down verse 7. Then the sailors said to each other, come, let us cast lots to find out who's responsible for this calamity. The storm has come. They want to know who's caused it. So they cast lots, and the lots fell on Jonah. Now, we're not entirely sure on kind of what exactly the drawing of lots involved. It's something between the kind of drawing of straws and the throwing of dice. Well, whatever it was, the lots were cast and they pointed to Jonah. Now, today, we may well say, well, that's just kind of chance. There's nothing to do with God there. That's kind of chance and probability and statistics, just kind of working itself out. And of course, it's right that probability and statistics are woven into our universe. Absolutely. But the author of Jonah wants us to see that behind that all, the one who controls it all is God. It's why Proverbs 16:33 says this. He says, the lot is cast into the lap, yeah? But it's every decision is from the Lord. You see, God, unlike us, never rolls the dice and holds his breath. He's in control of the smallest things. The big storms, the throw of the dice. He's even in control of Jonah, okay? Because Jonah, he was trying to run away from God. Well, by the end of chapter 1, he runs right into God. Have a look down verse 17. Because when Jonah's thrown into the sea, the huge ocean, miles upon square miles, what does he find? God is one step ahead of him, and he's provided a fish to swallow Jonah. Now, maybe there's some here, you've got questions, you're exploding with questions. Fish that swallowed a man? Come back next week and we'll take a look at it, okay? But the author's point is this, that if you started chapter 1 wondering what kind of control does God have, then we're in no doubt by the end of chapter 1. He's the God of the heaven who made the sea and the land, and he has authority over everywhere, everything, and everyone. Now, I want you just to remember that next time you're sitting in a lecture or a lesson, next time you're down at cribs, every single person you see is on God's turf. Every single thing that happens, happens because he allows it. You know, one of the things that kind of stops me from sharing the gospel with my friends is the sense that their lives are their own private property, okay? And I can't trespass into their lives with the gospel. I can't do it. It's not for me to go onto their land and interfere in their lives. But I hope you see how this picture of God challenges this. Colleagues, neighbours, friends, they're all on his turf. Now, that doesn't mean we can be rude and insensitive and pushy as we share the gospel with them. Absolutely not. We must be kind and gentle. But we must remember that everyone is living in God's world and needs his news. Okay? Everyone. We're living on God's land, on his turf, and we're in his hands. So suppose the question is, how then do we respond? Okay, that's our second point. The passage shows us a right response to God's sovereignty. And what it does is it contrasts how Jonah reacts with how the sailors react. Okay, so let's look at Jonah here. And as I've kind of been reading this over the past couple of weeks, what I've just been really struck by is Jonah says almost nothing in chapter one. Okay, he's basically totally silent. Now, Jonah, he got a tough call here to go to Nineveh and preach a difficult message. He wasn't the only one who got a tough call to do that. There's someone like Jeremiah, for example. He's gone called to go and preach a difficult message. And when he does, this is what he says to God. This is what Jeremiah says when he gets the tough call. He says, "Alas, sovereign Lord, I don't know how to speak. I'm too young." He's saying, "Really, God? You really want me?" He responds to God. But Jonah, he doesn't even bother responding. He just runs away. In the whole chapter here, Jonah doesn't engage with God once. Not once. So verse 6, have a look down. The captain of the ship, it's all going wrong. The captain of the ship goes to Jonah. He says, "How can you sleep? Get up, call on your God. Maybe he'll take notice of us so that we won't perish." How does Jonah respond? Total silence. Nothing. This ship is on the verge of sinking. And the sailors, who would know most about the odds, are saying, "Pray." You know, it seems to be a kind of natural instinct when death seems imminent. There seems to be some kind of natural instinct to call out to like a higher force or to pray. It just seems to be what people do. Jonah is totally silent. In fact, it's all the way until verse 9 before he speaks. So the sailors have just been barraging with question after question. "Where are you from? Who are you? What are you doing?" And it gets to a point where like it's just frankly embarrassing and he has to say something. So what he says down there in verse 9, he says, "I'm a Hebrew. I worship the Lord, the God of heaven, who made the sea and the land." Now, if I could kind of like click a sound effect button of canned laughter, this is when we press it. Because what Jonah says is ridiculous. Okay? If you ever wonder whether there's a sort of sense of humor or ire in the Bible, this is it. Because he doesn't worship God. It's the exact opposite. He's running away from God. Verse 9 should read, "I'm a Hebrew. I'm ignoring the Lord." Now, what he says in verse 9 is actually technically true. God does make the land and the sea. We've seen that, okay? Jonah, here's the thing. Jonah's theology is brilliant. But he's got no relationship with God. He doesn't engage with him once. And he certainly isn't willing to say sorry. So when the sailors ask him what to do, verse 12, he says, "Pick me up, throw me into the sea, it'll become calm. I know it's my fault that this great storm has come upon you." And that's the last we hear of him in this chapter. Sinks under the waves without even saying anything. Gone. So what about the sailors? How are they different? Have a look down verse 5. So the storm has hit the ship. All the sailors were afraid and each cried out to their own God. You see, the sailors respond with fear and prayer. Yeah, they're praying to their own God. They also don't quite know exactly what they're fearing. But what they kind of got is a sense that their lives are in the hands of someone greater than them. That's what they understand. And their fear levels actually keep on going up through the chapter. So when Jonah tells them that he worships the God who made the sea and the land, how do they respond? Verse 10, have a look down. Can you see? Terrified. Terrified. What have you done, Jonah? You're running away from the God who made the sea? What are you doing? You see, the more they learn of God, the more they fear him. And they do what Jonah doesn't. They pray. Verse 14, have a look down. They cried out to the Lord. Please, Lord, do not let us die for taking this man's life. And with that, they throw Jonah in, and suddenly the sea grows calm. And verse 15, as they see the sea calm, they greatly fear the Lord, because now what they suspected was true, now they know it's true. They know he really is the one in charge of the sea and all the elements. They know they're on his turf, at his mercy, in his hands. And so, what do they do, verse 16? They worship him. They offer him a sacrifice and make vows. You know, there's a way of reacting to God that will save you, and there's a way of reacting to God that will sink you. Okay, and it's all to do with the fear of God. It's all to do with the fear of God, which means we probably kind of need to understand what the fear of God is, which is brilliant because Jonah 1 is a great case study. Fearing God involves, and it's underwhelming, it involves fear. It involves fear. Now, the sailors, who I think are the models for us here, okay, they were scared, weren't they? Not just when the storm was raging, but actually when the seas grew calm. They were actually scared. And just like the sailors, we need to realize that even in calm waters, when life is good, in fact, especially when life is good, we need to realize we are all in God's hands on his turf. We are creatures in the hands of a very big creator. Now, if you have never trembled at the thought of God, it probably means you've tamed him. And it means you are not worshipping the God of Genesis 1, and you are not worshipping the God of Jonah chapter 1. Because Jonah 1 reminds us we're worshipping a God who controls every single aspect of this world. So in The Lion, the Witch and the Wardrobe, which I think may be familiar for some of us, there's this wonderful passage when the children meet Mr. and Mrs. Beaver, who tells them about Aslan, the Lion King. Is he a man? Asked Lucy. Aslan a man? Said Mr. Beaver sternly. Certainly not. I tell you, he's the king of the wood and the son of the great emperor beyond the sea. Don't you know the king of the beasts? Aslan is a lion. The lion. The great lion. Oh, said Susan. I thought he was a man. Is he quite safe? I shall feel rather nervous about meeting a lion. That you will, dearie, and no mistake, said Mrs. Beaver. If there's anyone who can appear before Aslan without their knees knocking, they're either braver than most or just silly. Then, isn't he safe? Asked Lucy. Safe, said Mr. Beaver. Don't you hear what Mrs. Beaver tells you? Who said anything about safe? Of course he isn't safe. But he is good. He's the king. And I think what we see here is that if there's been no knee knocking No trembling in your Christian life. It means you've probably tamed God. You've created a tabby cat kind of God when actually he's a roaring lion. And here's the thing. If your God is a tabby cat, you will never sell your house and take your children out of school and move to a different part of the city to tell other people about Jesus. Why would you ever do anything that inconvenient for a tabby cat? If your God is a tabby cat, why would you ever stick your neck above the parapet at work and speak out about the gospel and risk disciplinary action and being passed over the promotion for the sake of a tabby cat? And if you're here this afternoon, you wouldn't consider yourself a Christian, but you've got lots of questions. I don't know, maybe you're looking for a tabby cat kind of God, the kind of God who kind of will sit on your lap and keep you warm and purr when you give it a back scratch. But you won't find that kind of God in the Bible. You'll find him elsewhere. You'll find really entertaining tabby cat gods elsewhere, but you will not find him in the Bible, and you certainly don't find him in Jonah chapter 1. He is the God who controls it all. We're in his hands, on his turf, and so we do very, very well to tremble. But it should be the kind of trembling that drives us towards him rather than away from him. And that's because a proper fear of the God is, it is the fear of the one who longs to save us. He longs to save us. Think about it for a bit, right? Jonah didn't fear God, did he? And he was sunk. But the sailors feared God and they were saved. And that's my final point. This passage shows us the goodness of God's sovereignty. So have a look down verse 11. This is, I know we jumped around in the story a bit, but at this point the ship is about to go under. So the sailors turn to Jonah and say, "What should we do to you to make the sea calm for us?" And Jonah says, verse 12, "Well, pick me up and throw me in the sea and it'll go calm." Now, these sailors, they're not up for throwing Jonah in the sea, as grumpy as he is. So they think, we're going to row for shore. That's probably the way to get safe. And they try, verse 13, but they couldn't. The sea grew even wilder before. You see, it begins to dawn on them, by their own efforts, they will never make it to the safety of shore. And the only way for them to survive is for them to listen to what Jonah said. Verse 14. They cried out to the Lord, "Please, Lord, do not let us die for taking this man's life. Do not hold us accountable for killing an innocent man. For you, Lord, have done as you pleased." Then they took Jonah, threw him overboard, and the raging sea grew calm. God's prophet sinks. The sailors are saved. And of course, 750 years after this story, history kind of begins to repeat itself. In a slightly weird way, God's prophet, Jesus, was sunk so that people like you and me might be saved. No boat, no sea, but there was a storm. A storm of God's just anger broke over Jesus and sent him into the depths. And before it had happened, Jesus had even promised. He'd drawn the connection with Jonah. He'd said, "As Jonah was 3 days and three nights in the belly of a huge fish, so the Son of Man will be 3 days and three nights in the heart of the earth." See, Jesus knew he would be sunk for us so that we might be saved. Just think of Jonah drifting down into the depths. Cold water. And that is a picture of what Christ did for us. Because the truth is, we are all Jonah. We've all run away from God in different kind of ways. We're all basically kind of living in his world, and ignoring him. And so his anger is just. It's just. And the thing is, by our own efforts, we can't fix the relationship. We can't do it. You see, like the sailors, we want to try and row back to the safety on our own. We want to try and be good enough for God. But just try it. You'd be exhausted. And like the sailors, you'll be no closer to safety than you were when you started. We just don't have it in us. But of course, the news that Christianity offers is that God has done for us what we cannot do for ourselves. You see, this God who has authority over the huge waves and the dice, the sea and the land, the God who holds us in his hands, how does he use that authority and power? What does he do with all of it? Well, he makes a way to save us from his own judgment by sending the perfect prophet, the one who wasn't disobedient, who was sunk on the cross, so that we didn't need to sink. And he's the savior for anyone. Just think about these sailors who were saved. We don't know anything about them. We don't know what their history is, what kind of lives they lived. It's because it's totally irrelevant. It wasn't their behavior which saved them. It wasn't about them at all. They would not have got back to dry land and said, well done for us, that's why we're saved. They were saved because the prophet was sunk. It's all about the prophet. It's all about what happened to Jonah. It's all about what happened to Jesus. It's all about him, what he's done. And that means there's hope for anyone. There's hope for everyone because our backgrounds are totally irrelevant. So whatever kind of like New Year's you had, where the last year was a terrible year, where the past decade's been terrible, irrelevant. Totally irrelevant. It's all about what God's prophet has done to save you. He makes a way for you to be safe. Safe in the arms of the God who made the sea and the dry land. Yet we're on his turf. We're in his hands. We should fear him. He's not safe, but he's very, very good. And he's made a way for us to be safe. Let me pray. Father, we are sorry when we have tamed you, when we've made you safe. We're sorry when we've made you small, when you're very big. Please forgive us. Please give us the picture of Jonah 1. Remind us of your size and power and control and authority. Cause us to tremble, but cause us to tremble and fear and run towards you, knowing just how good you are. Amen.
Great, have a seat. Ian's going to come up now. Thank you, Ian, for a really helpful talk. Quite a few people have said thank you. We've got some really good questions here. Sort of three big themes, so we'll just take those if that's okay. First one's sort of about reading the Old Testament and Old Testament prophecy. People are a bit confused about who Jonah is in this and how we should relate to him. And how does Jonah look towards Jesus, but also be us? That some sort of so could you comment a bit, particularly about, you know, how does Jonah point towards? Yeah, is Jonah more like Jesus or more like us in this? I.e., if he's sinned and walked away from God,
yeah,
how can he also be mirroring Jesus?
Yeah. Hello. Well,
Jesus himself speaks of Jonah and says, if you want to understand something of me, look back to this story of Jonah. So Jesus isn't saying, run away, I'm running away from God like Jonah ran away from God. He was basically saying, I'm kind of going under like Jonah went under. So he's not saying, I am like Jonah. He's just saying, something will happen to me in the way it happened to Jonah. I think we'll go on to see, Jonah is just, in no chapter in this book is he a hero. In fact, in every chapter, he's pretty much a failure, and he's not a particularly nice guy, and he runs away from God. So in that sense, he's like us.
Okay, so maybe like us in the way he behaves more, but Jesus can use him to explain.
Okay. We'll explore a bit more of this as it goes on.
Yeah, great. And then there's a lot of questions, Ian, about this idea of God being in control and how does that work out in suffering.
Yeah.
So really helpful question about, you know, is God in control of the bushfires in Australia?
Yeah.
Is God allow cancer to happen? How does that work when God is sovereign and in control, but bad stuff happens to good people, people who love him?
Yeah.
How do we hold those two things together?
It's a very hard question to answer that. Maybe you're here asking that just kind of thinking, I wonder how that works. Or maybe something particularly bad has happened in your life and you're just thinking, I really need to understand how that works. I'm sorry, I can't give you a particularly easy answer to that. Can I just say a few things? One, at Emmanuel Bishopston this January, they're doing a short series on the book of Job. And in the book of Job, it's exactly this question which is happening, which is, why am I suffering? How can a good God allow bad things to happen to me? So you would probably do well to go onto the Emmanuel blog and kind of listen to those sermons as they go up, if that's the kind of question that's particularly pertinent for you. I'd say two more things. One is that we live in a very sinful world. Genesis 1 and then Genesis 2 and 3, the beginning of the Bible, shows that sin has entered the world. And as a result of that, is not how it should be. So fires are happening that shouldn't be happening. So we live in a broken world because of Adam and Eve's sin. And we live in a broken world to a large extent because of our sin as well. And yet, God uses everything, even some of the most terrible things, to achieve his purposes. I'm just trying to imagine like the worst situation. If you were here and you had a young child who just died, you're right, then let's get to the crux of it. And you're thinking, how on earth is God using that for his good? And I don't think I could give you an answer. But we know that the picture of him in Jonah 1 is he is in control. And he is good. He's a compassionate God. We'll see that in Jonah chapter 4. So we can't marry the two together. We're told that God is in charge. We're told it's a sinful world that's broken. And we're told that we're also responsible to live well in it, which we so often don't do.
Thank you. And the flip side of that is the last sort of theme. I'll read the question because it's easy that way. It says, perhaps for many people in suburban UK, life isn't a storm, it's a mill pond.
Mm-hmm.
Should we pray for more storms?
I think life might seem like a mill pond, but probably for quite a few of us, there will be at least some ripples. Some, there'll be more than that. I think one of the reasons why the church is growing in parts of the world like Asia and Africa and South America is because there is suffering there. And so people realize that they are not equipped to cope with life.
and they start looking for answers, and they find them in the gospel. The Chinese church, I think this is often repeated, I don't know who said this, but they pray for persecution on the Western church because they know that that's what will open people's eyes to the need to kind of respond to God well.